This is KYUK, public radio for the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. I'm Evan Erickson. In 2012, Jonathan Christ Tompkins dropped out of college to run for a seat in his Southeast Alaska House District based on his belief that lawmakers had been too generous with the way oil companies were taxed. Christ Tompkins won, beating out the Republican incumbent that year by a razor-thin margin, and went on to spend a decade representing his district in the legislature. After a two-year hiatus working with the National Science and Technology Policymaking Group, Christ Tompkins is vying for a shot at becoming Alaska's next governor. He's one of three Democrats running against a dozen Republicans and two independents in the 2026 race to replace Governor Mike Dunleavy. Christ Tompkins recently visited Bethel on the campaign trail, where he spoke with KYUK about the ways that his priorities as a candidate for governor are a continuation of the key issues he fought for as a state representative. This interview has been edited for length and clarity.
What kind of ideas are floating around in your head about policies the state could maybe have a positive impact on the many issues facing the YK Delta?
One of the key things on my mind is the cost of living and the ability for people in rural Alaska to be able to have a living and be able to get by. And I think that's, you know, it's true everywhere, but it's of course massively, massively more a factor out here and in other rural parts of Alaska. And that's a really major concern for me. I think there's a lot of state services and programs that are important to rural Alaska. We're in KYUK studios right now. When I was in the legislature, fighting for support for public broadcasting was something really important to me. But sort of down the list, these, you know, state programs that sort of make life more equitable in Alaska, both in urban and rural areas, is something that's really important to me. A lot of time spent talking about fisheries and how the state should be playing, I think, much more of a leadership role around fisheries management, and specifically the North Pacific Fishery Management Council. I spent years going to council meetings. I think I was often the only legislator out of the 60 in Juneau who would go to North Pacific Council meetings because, up until, the last year or two, it's this obscure body, but it's incredibly powerful, and the decisions they make affect all of Alaska. And I was, as a legislator, and I still am, very frustrated that the council members, especially the six that come from Alaska, there's the others from Washington and Oregon, and I think that's a little bit of a different situation, although I still disagree with some of their votes and policy perspectives. But especially the six members from Alaska should have the interests of Alaska subsistence, subsistence in Alaska and the commercial fisheries fleets that are home ported in Alaska. Not in Seattle, not in Newport, Oregon, but in Alaska, in Sitka and Seward and Homer and Ketchikan, in our Alaska communities. And I often felt like the council was making decisions with the interests of Seattle first in mind. And that was really frustrating to me. And so I would go to council meetings and testify. I would author sign-on letters. Having sort of been in the trenches at the council for years and years, I'm very motivated to make sure that there's council nominations and representation that care about communities like Bethel and villages up and down the Kuskokwim.
What, in your opinion, can the state do to facilitate rebuild efforts and potential relocation for the communities hit hardest by ex-Typhoon Halong who are displaced here in Bethel? We have a bunch of families here in other villages and then obviously hundreds in Anchorage with no idea what comes next.
The state should be the number one advocate for making sure that we get the federal funds and resources to be able to provide for recovery efforts. And, in many ways, that's, the federal government has that role. They have the resources, and the state should be a zealous advocate to make sure that those resources make their way to the villages and families that are affected. I think there's a lot of sort of coordination ability. I think in many regards, the state undervalues the value that tribes can bring, and working together with the tribes in the YK Delta and with AVCP, I think, is another role the state can play, again, to sort of coordinate response.
There's a lot of schools in this region that are languishing on the state's major maintenance list. How would you begin to tackle the issue of schools languishing on this maintenance list?
The state has a constitutional obligation to make sure our schools are safe and well-maintained. And I think there's good reason to believe that is not the case right now. And by hook or by crook, the state needs to do right by our kids, including kids in rural Alaska. Ultimately, it's a question of money and it's a question of priorities. And for me, education is one of the state's most important priorities. There needs to be meaningful capital funding every year for deferred maintenance of schools, including rural Alaska and REAAs. It should be in bond packages if necessary. And ultimately, this all kind of circles back to, you know, the revenue question. And, you know, in order to be able to fund this, we need to make sure we have revenues. And I think it's important that the state get its fair share of oil, which, unfortunately, since the passage of the oil tax cuts in 2013, I don't think has been the case for the state.
That was Jonathan Christ Tompkins speaking with me, KYUK's Evan Erickson, on Tuesday about his candidacy in the 2026 Alaska governor's race. Find a longer version of this interview covering topics not included here at KYUK.org. The first third of the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race has seen a bit of everything, from severe wind chill to watery overflow and even some wildlife. Front-of-the-pack teams zipped through the interior hub of McGrath late on Tuesday night and early Wednesday morning, but several others stayed at the checkpoint for their mandatory 24-hour breaks. Alaska Public Media's Ava White has more from McGrath, more than 300 miles into the 1,000-mile race.
Defending champion Jesse Holmes was first to McGrath late Tuesday, but he only stopped for a few minutes to grab supplies from his drop bags, including frozen fish to feed his team.
I'm getting these dogs well taken care of, getting ready for the next stages of the race. I expect it to continue to be tough, so need to get well rested there and get the dogs and myself refueled for the journey.
Front-running mushers like Holmes and frequent top 10 finisher Paige Drobny, both from the Denali Highway area, opted to blow through McGrath, headed for the village of Takotna, where they bedded down their dogs to take their 24s. Others, like up-and-comer Riley Dyke and Matt Hall, the runner-up the last 2 years, passed those staying in Takotna and headed for the ghost town checkpoint of Ophir for their 24-hour rest. It's been cold all along the trail so far. Teams experienced wind chill down to 45 below near McGrath and even colder in lower-lying areas. Sophomore Iditarod musher Keaton Lobrick says his boots were frozen when he pulled into McGrath this morning.
It always feels colder on, I don't know if that's the river or whatever that was. But my feet, I mean, these are frozen solid.
Josie Shelley is another veteran musher from Fairbanks in the 2024 Iditarod Rookie of the Year. She won the first Yukon Quest Alaska 750 in mid-February and laughs when asked about the cold weather.
I did the Yukon Quest. It was like 68 below. So this, I mean, I don't like the 40 below, but I'm also not. It's fine.
Shelley spent 6 hours in the McGrath checkpoint and squeezed in a 2-hour nap, her longest since the race started, before heading farther down the trail. But not everyone continued down the trail. A handful of mushers declared their 24-hour rests in McGrath, including Jeff Dieter, another Fairbanks musher. Dieter is competing in his 9th Iditarod and says his 16-dog team is doing great and eating like wolves. He says that's a good sign.
I was trying not to go into my 24 with any sort of depletion of the team. Like, I wanted to catch them while they're still sound and hungry and feeling their best so that we can build on that and actually leave here really ready for the final two-thirds of this race.
Coming into the checkpoint, Dieter says he ran into overflow that left the entire team soaking wet with an ambient temperature of 25 below. Mushers also spoke of running into bison earlier in the race, heading through the Farewell Burn after the treacherous Dalzell Gorge. Willow musher Gabe Dunham is terrified of them and says they were standing right at the edge of the trail.
then they kind of moved off a little bit, and we snuck by them really quick, but Jason Mackey was right behind me, and he was like, they were so close.
There was no bison on the menu for Dunham and McGrath, where she was taking her 24-hour layover and had Southwestern chicken and rice for breakfast Wednesday. Stopping here, she says, is part of a challenging but strategic plan.
I chose to come here because it sets me up to where now I'll go to Ophir and I'll stay there for a break after this. And then that sets my team up for hopefully 3 runs into Ruby.
The first musher to Ruby, where teams reach the Yukon River, wins a gourmet meal cooked by flown-in chefs that is sometimes eaten, like Dunham's chicken and rice, for breakfast, just depending on when they arrive. In McGrath, I'm Ava White.
This is KYUK News. I'm Evan Erickson. Koyana for listening. Please share your news tips, comments, or suggestions. You can email us at news@kyuk.org or message us on Facebook. And stay tuned for Yoktun Ganumchit coming up.